Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18+. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Hello. Welcome to the Snooker Scene podcast. I'm Dave Hendon. And to quote President Gerald Ford, a long national nightmare is over. Now, he was talking about the post-Watergate era in America. I'm talking about the fact that the new snooker season is upon us. It starts here this week in Leicester with the BetVictor Championship League. And we'll continue, of course, all the way through until the World Championship next May. It's been 2 months. There's been things happening, of course. There's been seniors and Q School and various amateur events and so on. So it's not been a completely barren spell. But in terms of the professional circuit, which is what most people are interested in, it's been about 8 weeks since Ronnie O'Sullivan won his seventh world title. And we're easing ourselves back into the new season with the Championship League. And the podcast is back. And there's big news on the podcast coming later about the future of it. I mean, I could just tell you now, but I'm gonna tease it out to infect phony drama into the podcast, which of course is all the rage on television. So rather than just telling you now, it's a bit like when Hugh Edwards comes on at the start of the news. There's been a big Champions League night, football this is, and instead of telling you what's happened, it'll say something like it was a big night for Liverpool in the Champions League. But he won't actually tell you what happened because there's no other way of finding out other than watching to the end of the news. Anyway, we'll also later on have an email from Neil Folds, who's got a new idea that he's interested in bringing into the sport. So a lot to look forward to, clearly. Thanks to everyone who emailed in. I dropped a little episode last week about asking for people, fans of snooker, to come on a fan special because... I wanted to get to fans' perspective on attending tournaments, what's good about it, what's not so good, ideas and general sort of contributions and observations about what it's like to be a snooker fan. Thank you to everyone who emailed in. I have chosen three people who are going to come on. It's nothing against anyone who haven't chosen, so if you've not heard from me, thank you for emailing. And a lot of people did. I had to whittle it down. It's a bit like Judges' Houses on X Factor. There's another up-to-date cultural reference. I had to choose, and I've chosen for a variety of reasons these people, because they're all people who've got a lot of experience of going, and they made some good points in their emails. But that's nothing against anyone who I haven't chosen. I will be reading out other contributions. There's still time recording it next week, so there's time if you have any observations about your time as a snooker fan, any ideas for improving the experience, and what is your experience? Tell me what it's been like going to these events, how the venues differ. He's always interesting, what's available at venues, all that sort of stuff. snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. That's snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. Well, I've not been completely idle since the Crucible. One thing I have been doing is just taking the time to have a look at the way a few other sports operate and what maybe snooker can learn from them. Because I thought we would start on this return. By the way, this is our 8th year. I should say that right from the off. 8th year, we started in 2015. We've not been here every week since then. But it's season 8 of... That's the time when... season 8 of an American TV drama is the time usually it gets cancelled. But anyway, we're still here. And, you know, we were here, is it 2015? This is pre-Brexit, pre-Donald Trump, pre-Boris Johnson, pre-Bridgerton. All these horrors were still to come. It was, they're innocent times. The whole back catalogue is available online if you want to go back and listen to some old episodes. But anyway, I thought we would start this season by really taking a look at the current state of snooker. Where does it stand? And maybe a few ideas about how we can sort of push forward. I think the danger always is you reach a certain level, and snooker's reached a very high level, clearly, in terms of a professional sport that has a lot of television exposure. The danger is you just sort of plateau and you don't push forward and you settle and you get complacent, and we need to guard against that as a sport, I think. Snooker's in a very good state, as I say, due to television. We have a massive footprint on free-to-air television. That's one thing I've noticed about quite a few other sports are now very interested in getting back on free-to-air TV. I'm talking from a British television perspective here because that's where I live. So I'm talking BBC and ITV, Channel 4, Channel 5, these channels that you don't have to pay a subscription for outside of obviously the licence fee. So sports like rugby league, rugby union have noticed trying to come back on. Cricket's got more of a footprint now. It had, of course, the 100 last year was on the BBC, and the highlights from the test series are quite prominent now on the BBC. Sports understand that, you know, it's good. Obviously, sports channels are great because they have the time. They have the time during the day to show the action, and also they can come at it from the perspective they know their audience are sports fans because they're watching sports channels, so they can tailor the coverage to them. But it's good to actually have a general audience as well that's available to you. And we've seen, for example, in football, the FA Cup being on BBC and ITV, you know, the viewing figures are fantastic. So, but we're already there. BBC, ITV in the UK both show a lot of snooker. Free Sports show the Championship League, although I've been told that Free Sports... the name of the channel may need to change because apparently it's coming off Freeview this week. Now, Freeview, for those maybe outside the UK, that is essentially the basic TV package you get. You get over 100 channels, but you don't have to pay extra for any of them. Whereas satellite and digital TV, the subscriptions and so on. So I'm not quite sure. They do have a streaming service. I'm not quite sure how exactly you watch that, but Free Sports is still available on other platforms, but apparently this week it is coming off Freeview. But anyway, in general, we have a lot of snooker on ITV and BBC. I mean, combined, just those two channels combined, that's a good 70 days of snooker. You've got Quest, which is another Freeview channel that show the home nations in conjunction with Eurosport. So that's another 4 weeks. That's another... Let's call it 30 days. So it's about 100 days, just those three, of free-to-air snooker, plus all the coverage that Eurosport give it, you know, which is over 100 days. Some of that is the same days, of course. But, yeah, it's a lot. And then you've got, you know, I think Matchroom Live and DAZN and all these other outlets around the world, I believe on Facebook as well, some of it's been shown. So... in theory, wherever you are in the world, you should be able to watch snooker. Now, whether that's absolutely true, I can't say. But put it this way, it's more accessible than it's ever been. And that's good because it's always been a sport that's been big because of television. And, you know, obviously now the internet as well has helped to spread the word. So we've got a good platform. It's a high-profile sport. We saw great viewing figures at the World Championship, particularly the final. I think a lot of people bought into this sense of history that Ronnie O'Sullivan was chasing with the... equaling the Stephen Hendry's record of 7 world titles. But the other tournaments as well get very, very good figures across the board. Snooker is a popular TV sport. So we're starting, actually, when I say the current state of snooker, we're starting in a very good position. The question is, how do we sort of keep pushing on? How do we stay relevant? How do we stay on people's radar? Because the fact is, we're not just competing against other sports. We're a TV product. We're competing against other TV shows. And, of course, now with all the streaming services, there are hundreds of other things people could be watching if they've got time to watch TV. And we're also competing against the other ways that people spend their leisure time. So what is it about snooker that has to stay special and has to stay relevant for people to choose our sport? overall, audience figures on TV, as I say, very good. And ticket sales also have been very, very good. Obviously, coming back after COVID, I think it was a great desire for people to come back. And we saw at the Masters, I think, certainly, the desire to come and watch live snooker. And we saw it again at the Crucible as well. World Snooker Tour, who run the professional circuit, have a problem at the moment. And it's quite a straightforward one. It's China. Okay, because of COVID, they don't know when they can go back to China. Now, the new calendar, if you've been sort of checking the World Snooker Tour website for the season's dates, it only goes up to the end of this year, the calendar year, 2022. I understand the rest of the calendar will be released this week. It may even be out by the time you listen to this. There'll be at least one new event on it as well, which is good. So the new calendar's coming out, but it's been very, very difficult. I do have sympathy with Nigel Oldfield, who's the operations executive there, and his team, just trying to plan the season, because they were hoping to go back to China early next year. They essentially, initially when they were planning the calendar, they blocked out a month where they might be able to fit as many as three Chinese tournaments in back-to-back. They were hoping to go to Shanghai in September for an invitation event, but it's looking increasingly likely that none of that's going to happen. It's looking like, again, we won't be going back to China. There's not been a tournament there since 2019. They've had more lockdowns. I was reading today that there hasn't been any COVID cases reported in Shanghai this month, but that's following a lockdown. So even if we did somehow get there, you know, it might be that the players would have to quarantine. There would be a bit of a rigmarole just to get in and play. It would take a big chunk of time maybe to play a week-long tournament. There'd be quarantining possibly either side of it. So whether that's, you know, realistic or whether they would again push back and maybe leave it till next season, we'll have to see. But it's been very difficult. And of course, the big issue is that these tournaments are really lucrative, or they were. You know, we would go to China as many as five times a season. The players were playing for big money. They were big tournaments, and we miss them. And it's not straightforward to just automatically replace them like for like, because they were underpinned by Chinese sponsors. So the money was coming from China. World Snooker Tour can't just pull on another five events of equivalent value somewhere else. It doesn't work like that. So it's difficult, and they have my sympathy. Planning the calendar has been tricky. We'll see what we end up with when it comes out. But I suspect it'll be not dissimilar to last year. Still plenty of tournaments, but, you know, not quite of the scale maybe that we saw before the pandemic. Championship League has come along to fill a gap. You know, people have a go at it, but ultimately, you know, players are getting a chance in very early season to play for prize money, to get match practice. I think one of the best things about it is you're guaranteed three matches, actually. You turn up, you know, you might be rusty after the summer, but you're not going to play and lose and go home. If you lose the first match, you've got two more to play, and then a chance to come back for the next two stages. But as I say, we'll see what the rest of the calendar says. But in general, just looking at the sport, we've reached, as I say, a particular level, and that's in no small part down to the work that Barry Hearn and his team have done over the last decade. And actually, it must be said, because of talking about COVID, the fact we were able to keep going is testament to how well Matchroom is run as a company, and the fact that they had the reserves, they had the rainy day fund that they used, not just on snooker, but all their other sports, to keep going, keep providing an income for the players and entertainment that I know a lot of snooker fans appreciated when they were stuck at home. So, you know, no question, full marks for all that. I guess now, though, as we come out of COVID, or we hope to, how do we make the best out of the sport? One of the main problems is, and it's already apparent from what I've said, one of the main problems we've got is that it's still primarily a British sport. It's the World Snooker Tour, but I counted 13 events in the United Kingdom. Now, that's great for British snooker fans, obviously, and this is the traditional base of the sport. OK, but for the sport to be really successful, we need to spread our wings more. We do have tournaments. We have two in Germany. There's the new event in Turkey. And I know they're exploring at least one other European destination. You know, very, very strong chance that there'll be a tournament there this season. But other than that, it seems to be largely be a British sport, and of course that's reflected in the number of players on the tour from the UK. There was a discussion about, I can't even remember the specifics, but it was something to do with Q School, and I think I suggested, yeah, that's right, yeah, Joe Perry put something up about, you know, we want more young players to come through, and I suggested having a separate Q School event, maybe for players under 25, so you're guaranteed some new players. There's arguments against that because the standard may not be high enough for them to do well on the tour. But someone said, oh, well, you know, it's got to be merit. It's got to be on merit. But what does that mean? Because not everyone has the same opportunity to play snooker. It's the most, one of the most pointless phrases you'll hear in sport is, if you're good enough, you'll make it. Because that ignores a key question, which is, how do you become good in the first place? It's only through resources and infrastructure and, above all, opportunity. And where does the opportunity come from? You need somewhere to play snooker. If Ronnie O'Sullivan had been born in Ecuador in 1975, he would not be seven times world champion because he would not have seen a snooker table. So spreading opportunity is important. Now, snooker is played all around the world and it's played in more countries than ever, but obviously a lot of these countries have got a lot of catching up to do. And ultimately, they all face the same issue, which is if they want to turn pro, and we've got some new pros from various parts of the world, which is good, but if they want to turn pro, they've essentially got to base themselves in the UK. And not everyone can afford to do that. Not everyone has funding. Igor Figueiredo from Brazil, fantastic talent, really brilliant player, but he's had to essentially pack it in because he can't afford to keep coming over to the UK. And we have these ludicrous situations where, for example, Lukas Kleckers from Germany has got back on the tour. Brilliant. Well done to him. But if he's going to play at the German Masters in Berlin, he's got to win two matches in the UK. He's got to qualify for his home tournament in Germany in the UK. Just seems wrong. So this is not something that can be changed overnight. It's something that maybe should have been looked at, you know, many, many years ago. But for the sport to really, really compete on a global level, it has to become more global. It can't just be based in Britain. Obviously, China, in terms of participation, have had a massive influence on the circuit. But this is kind of the point I'm making. You know, it's not a genetic reason why the best players are from Britain and China. It's about opportunity. It's about structure. It's about infrastructure. And it's about having that those resources to play. And this is something that if we're projecting 10 years from now, how will the game become more international? Well, it has to be that more countries have these opportunities. One thing I think that would help is, and this is not a new idea at all because it's what happened in the 1980s, if snooker started to visit a few more countries, but not with big ranking events that, you know, cost hundreds of thousands to put on. They've had the World Series of Darts where they go to various parts of the world with a small number of players. A few small invitation events, 4-man, 8-man, however many players, to far off places, I think would really help, because then they could see in these countries the game. Barry Hearn's Matchroom went to Thailand in the 80s. James Wattenaar, I think, was 16. He played in it. And of course, that was the start of his great career. We've seen that happen in China, happen in various other parts of the world as well, in Europe, Belgium and places like this, Holland. And I think that would help spread snooker's appeal if some of these countries, rather than watching the players on TV, had a chance to see them up front. There was plans for an event in Hong Kong in August. We heard nothing more about that, so I'm assuming it's not happening, but it may happen at some point in the future. But I think that would really help. The problem is, of course, now Barry is running, he's president of the World Snooker Tour. We're told he's retired, but I mean, yeah, I don't think Barry's a retiring type. But now, of course, he's got to look after every player. But even then, you know, you hear some low-ranked players say, oh, you know, there's too many tournaments for the top players, which is complete nonsense, because the Kazoo Series, for example, which they point at because they're ranking events, but they're a restricted field, anyone can get in them. They're not for the top players. They're for the players who perform the best over the season. Jimmy Robertson nearly dropped off the tour in 2021, but he stayed on. And then last season, he had a great season, and he ended up in the semi-finals of the Players' Championship, which is a 16-man event. But that's because he played really well during the season. That's the attitude players should have. It's not that the fields are restricted. It's that I could get in them if I do well. And those events, you know, those high-prestige events, I think they really help to sell the game. The way I see it, we have two constituencies that we're trying to appeal to. Snooker fans, so people who already watch the sport, and they should be respected, and the integrity of the game should be respected in terms of what people who have been watching it all their lifetime want. But the other constituency is people who could be snooker fans, but for whatever reason haven't found their way into the game yet. And I'm not suggesting you can just sort of lift up a rock and there's 2 million people waiting to discover snooker, but there's an opportunity, particularly, you know, with online activities, to actually foreground the players a bit more, maybe. Maybe that's a way in to finding snooker, becoming interested in the characters of the players. Here, a lesson I learned from playwriting very early on. Someone said to me, the most important thing to think about are the characters, not the story, the characters, because the characters are the way in for the audience. And the example he used, and it's an example I always use when I'm talking about this, is the film Titanic. Okay, put aside what you think about the film, it doesn't matter. But in that film, hundreds of people die when the ship sinks. But the audience, we only care about two of them, Kate and Leo. Why? Because right from the start of the film, we've been following their story. We've got to know them. We've got to know them individually. We've got to know them as a couple. So we care about them as a couple. Therefore, we care whether they live or die. All the other people falling off the side of the ship, we haven't spent any time with, so we can't relate to them. And I think if you're promoting a sport, that's kind of the strategy you've got to have. You've got to promote the characters as much as the sport. Because snooker's, it's not the easiest sell. If you say to someone who's never been, oh, do you want to come to the snooker? How are you going to sell it? You've got to come sit for possibly 4 hours at a time. Oh, by the way, you can't use your phone and you can't talk, basically. You've got to sit in silence and watch these people, you know, knocking balls around and trying to get them into holes. It's not the easiest sell, actually. Because you look at darts on TV or cricket or football, the kind of atmosphere speaks for itself, but snooker is very different, and it's what a lot of people like about it, actually. But they're established fans. I'm talking about people who could be fans. But if they see a lifestyle feature on one of the players, they may think, oh, he looks interesting, she looks interesting. Yeah, tell me when they're playing, I'll go and watch them. This is why I think Ronnie O'Sullivan's documentary on, we believe, on Netflix later in the year, because they followed him all last season, culminated at the Crucible. I think that's why that will be very important, actually, for the sport. Because although it's focusing very much on him, it will help to... It will be exposure for the sport to a different audience. People will watch that who maybe have never even watched a snooker match. And that could help bring people to the sport. There was a thing last week that World Snooker Tour did with Dave Gilbert and Rob Walker on Dave's farm. They were in his tractor, which was, I thought it was a lot of fun. I like Rob a lot. I like Dave a lot. It was a lot of fun. But I also wondered, is it a bit of an in-joke for snooker fans? Because we know them. We know Dave. We know Rob. From the outside, people looking at that, what's their way in? And I've said before, I can never remember whether I've said it on the podcast or just in everyday life, I think there is a big argument for trying to, when they do these features, to try and get someone involved who's got nothing to do with snooker, but's got a big following. ITV did a feature with Judd Trump at one of the tournaments a couple of years ago, and Chris Hughes came over, I think it was in Cheltenham, and Chris Hughes, he was on Love Island, but he works on ITV's racing coverage. He's a smart guy, and he's got millions, literally millions, of social media followers. And that feature he did with Trump was a massive hit online because it was something very different. It was someone who wasn't connected to snooker, but was much nearer Trump's age. So they were talking about things that were relevant to their generation, like music and fashion and nights out and so on. But most importantly, Chris Hughes, people who follow him maybe don't follow snooker, but they'll watch content he's involved in, and it did massive numbers. And that's the sort of thing that maybe can help snooker, particularly with audiences that we don't really understand, because, you know, as technology moves on, there'll be a 14-year-old on TikTok, you know, that means nothing at all to even a 20-something who's you know, working in the media. So, you know, ideas like that, I think, can help push snooker forward. And instead of doing the World Snooker did a feature, What's in My Cue Case, well, that's, again, of interest to the first constituency I mentioned, snooker fans. Diehard snooker fans will be interested in that. But there's no way in for the second constituency, which is people who have not discovered snooker yet. However, something like What's in My Wardrobe, or What's on My Watch List, or What's in My Fridge, you know, things that people can understand in everyday life in the ordinary world, maybe that would be a way in. Maybe if you said Chris Hughes round to Judd Trump's house and went through his wardrobe, what do you wear on a night out? What do you wear when you're just slobbing around the house? What do you wear to the gym? What do you wear, you know, to a wedding, whatever? That would be relatable because we could all understand it. And then maybe they would see that and say, oh, I like the look of Judd. Let me know when he's playing in the next tournament. I may even come along. So what I'm saying is, we can't just aim everything at the first constituency, which is people who already like snooker. We've got them already. We must respect them and keep them. But there's a lot of other people, potentially, who we could also drag into our little world. They won't be listening to this podcast, but who knows? There may be a way in for them to discover the game. And these are things... I mean, Barry Hearn is a genius at understanding what people like, sometimes before they like it. And that's why his events across all sports have been so popular. But I do think, in terms of reaching out to this new audience, we need to come up with these ideas and try them. And even to the extent that, you know, there's been innovations, I know not everyone's like having a dance cam and all that sort of stuff, but it's things that are related to other live events and other sports that, again, you know, some people who maybe put off snooker by the fact they think it's a bit kind of dull, it may appeal to them, you know, and it's always worth trying these things. I think as well, the whole sport needs to try and be a bit more positive about the sport. I'm always surprised when, at the major events in particular, and the World Championship obviously is the biggest of them all, so many players seem to turn up with a laundry list of of complaints about their own sport. And I remember speaking to Ken Doherty about this once, and he said, really, if you're trying to earn a living from something, it's in your interest to talk it up as much as possible. Now, that's not to say you can never criticise. I mean, check out the previous episodes of this podcast. There are things to criticise, and we should always scrutinise any government, any governing body. But, for example, there's a new tournament being announced, I believe, this week, which is very different to anything else on the circuit. So when it's announced, here's an idea. Don't rush to Twitter finding things to complain about it when it hasn't even happened yet. Maybe try and find something positive to say about it. You know, it's we don't have to just look for the negatives in everything. It's interesting. I was watching Paul McCartney at Glastonbury. Well, there's two secrets to his success. The one is an obvious one. He's a great songwriter and he's got a credible back catalogue. But the other one is he's 80 now, Paul McCartney. He has stayed positive and optimistic. His entire sort of life philosophy is to kind of look on the bright side. And I think a lot of people are looking for that now. You know, we're living in a time of division. And we saw in the Platinum Jubilee as well in Britain, people actually are looking for ways to come together. This is one of the reasons these terrible right-wing news channels are failing, because people don't want division. They don't want to be set against each other. They actually want to come together, to use a Beatles song title. And, you know, he got up and he played his set. He didn't treat us to, you know, what he thought about politics and make statements and all this. And he's seen, I mean, the Beatles started out as an incredibly optimistic band coming through the post-war era in Britain when people were looking for things to change. They had that optimistic tone, which they just about kept throughout the whole career. There were some songs that were not like that, but mainly, right to the end, they were this positive force, and that's why I think they've stayed so culturally relevant. Whereas a lot of music over the years has been very much downbeat and all life's terrible and we're all going to die and isn't it all awful. I don't think people overwhelmingly want that. And we saw the force of the positivity that he brought to the Glastonbury stage on Saturday night. And, you know, maybe we could try in the snooker world to be a bit more positive about our own sport. We have various players who at times act like they're too cool for school. You know, oh, I don't watch snooker on TV, I'm not bothered about it. Let's be clear, we wouldn't know the names of any of them but for snooker. So, you know, but for snooker, maybe they could ask themselves what they'd be doing. So, again, it's a great sport. Embrace it, promote it, be positive about it, and try to push it to as many people as possible. That's in all our interests. That's my kind of manifesto, but that's my kind of point as the season starts. I think snooker's in a good place, but I think there's an opportunity for it to be bigger. I think there's an opportunity to, as I say, discover some new audiences. And I think there's an opportunity to, as a sport, be a bit more positive about what we have. Because what we have is a product that has stood the test of time. And, Yeah, I'm looking forward to the season ahead. So let's move on to this email from Neil Folds. It's actually two emails, but it was supposed to be one, I believe. I don't know what went wrong, but anyway. I must say, when I got this initially, I did wonder if Neil had actually been kidnapped and was trying to communicate with me by code to let me know where he was. But it turned out, I believe he's being serious. It's about the ranking system. He says, I hope you're summering well and enjoying a well-earned break. Clearly, as we find ourselves in the height of the silly season, where there isn't any real snooker news, perhaps now is time to look into the rankings and a possible change to the way players are ranked. The phrase I'd hold on to there is silly season. Anyway, we continue. I think we all understand that luck of the draw, good and bad, can play a huge part in how a tournament unfolds. But below is an example of a ranking order based on the performances of the players beaten at the Crucible. Clearly Ronnie is still number one, otherwise my listings would become ludicrous, but everyone is ranked on the performances of the person who went on to beat them, or in Ronnie's case, didn't. Anyway, below is the list as it stands. That was the first email. Then the second email, it has the list. He says, I won't read the list out, but I'll explain it shortly. He says, in fact, I chose to send it as a follow-up email because I didn't want anyone to hack into this ranking list and claim it as their own. Nothing personal, but Jamie Jones finished 32nd of the players who competed in Sheffield because he lost to Mark Selby, who lost to Yanbing Tao, who lost to Mark Williams, who lost to Judd, who lost to Ronnie. Whereas Dave Gilbert, who lost to the eventual winner in round one, is 17th on the list. All of the players in all rounds are ranked according to the player performances of whoever beat them, thus negating the luck of the draw aspect. You're rewarded for winning, but if you lose, you are judged by the performance of your victor. How the points should be distributed is another matter, but it would make players who are in or close to a qualifying bubble dependent on what happens after they lose. You may think this idea is complete nonsense, but I believe it to be the way forward. Well, okay, so he sent the 32 players based on the World Championship. Obviously, Ronnie O'Sullivan won the tournament, so he's number one. Judd Trump was runner-up, he's number two. And then we have the semi-finalists, Higgins and Williams, and so on and so on. So the top 16 are the players who got to the last 16. And then the 16 players who lost in the first round are ranked dependent on who they lost to. So Dave Gilbert lost to the eventual winner, Ronnie O'Sullivan, so he's 17th. Hussein Vafai lost to the runner-up, Judd Trump, so he's 18th, and so on and so on. As Neil says, eventually we come down to 32nd, Jamie Jones. So, Neil says, I might think this idea is complete nonsense. I don't think that. Lunacy might be a better word for it. Here's the problem I have with it, okay? And presumably this would be extrapolated to include every tournament. I'm not quite sure how that would work. You would need some sort of spreadsheet and probably a calculator. But here's the thing, okay? I commentated a lot for tournament. The person who played, I think, the best in the first round and lost was Ding Junhui. He played really well against Karen Wilson, lost 10-8, had a chance to force a decider, Mr. Pink. But on this list, he's 30th because of the rules that Neil has set out. Whereas, for example, let's just pick a player. Michael White lost 10-3 to Mark Williams. I mean, Mark played brilliantly, but Michael White won three frames at the Crucible, and he's 20th on this list, whereas Ding is 30th. And also, just because a player wins a tournament doesn't mean they play well in every round. I mean, when Trump won it, he probably should have lost in the first round in 2019. The classic case of that is Stuart Bingham in 2015. He didn't play well in the first round against Robbie Williams. He had a heavy cold, I believe, and we just struggled. Last three rounds, he played brilliantly. He beat Ronnie, he beat Trump, and he beat Sean Murphy. But in the first round, he didn't play well. But on this basis, on Neil's list, Robbie Williams will be 17th. And he, you know, certainly didn't play the best snooker in the first round of the players who lost. So that's a slight issue I have with it. And also, you know, I suppose just the obvious question, why should Dave Gilbert be above all the other players just because he lost to the person who eventually won the tournament? Sure, doesn't performance come into it? I do wonder if we're going to change the ranking system, which, by the way, they have no idea of doing at the moment. But maybe you could factor in actually how many frames you've won. Maybe you could get points for winning frames, maybe even breaks. I mean, literally some recognition of how you performed. Because otherwise, on this metric, Gilbert could have lost 10-0 to Ronnie and he still would have been 17th above all the other players who lost in the first round. There are people who, cleverer than me, who've come up with various systems to encompass the whole tour, factoring in who you played. But as I say, just because you played someone who goes a long way in the tournament doesn't necessarily reflect how they played. I mean, Ronnie played well against Gilbert because he played well against everybody. He was 3-0 down early on. He played well in that match. He played well in every match. So this year, it's not that he got better and better. I think he played to a very consistent level the whole tournament. But in general, as I say, for example, Bingham in 2015, he didn't in the first round. But, you know, on this basis, Robbie Williams would have a huge rankings boost. So it's an interesting idea. It's nice to know that Neil is, you know, spending his time wisely. And I don't think it's going to catch on. But it did lead me to the ranking system was pretty much set for a long time. Very much simple system where you essentially got a point for winning a round. If you won a ranking event, you got 6 points. The World Championship was 10. But in a normal ranking event, you got 6 points, runner-up 5, semis 4, quarters 3, and so on, all the way down to merit points, which we won't go into that right now. But in 92, they changed it. And I've got here, if I can find the page, the edition of Snooker Scene. It's August 92. Just bear with me while I find the page. They changed the format. Here we are. So from going from getting 6 points for winning a tournament, a standard ranking event, you got 3,600. And it was effectively more or less 400 points a round. So the runner-up got 3,200, semis 2,800, quarters 2,400, etc., etc. The UK Championship was higher tariff, 4,500, and then it went down in 500-point increments. So the runner-up got 4,000, semis 3,500, quarters 3, and so on. And the World Championship was 6,000 to the winner, and it went down in 600-point increments. 5,400 runner-up, 4,800 for the semis, and so on and so on. So it was it felt like a big change at the time, but it had a certain logic in terms of how the ranking points were spread. It was still, essentially, you were getting the same number of points for winning a round in each round. So whether it be 400 points or 500 or 600, it was like before when it was 1 point, but there was a logic to it. What's happened, of course, in recent times is it's a money list. And under the money list, it's dependent on the prize money for that specific event. And that's why it's become so top heavy. That's why it's so difficult now to become a top 16 player unless you win a tournament or are very, very consistent in reaching a lot of finals, as Jack Lazowski has been. I mean, Jack's 10 without winning a tournament, which I think is a great achievement, actually. But this system that they established in 92-93, I mean, the rather dismissive sort of argument against it was that people said John Spencer, the chairman, had worked it out on the back of a cigarette packet, which I don't think was true. I mean, you probably would have needed something bigger than that. Whether he worked it out or not, I don't know. But actually, you look at it, and I think this system is possibly a good middle ground, because it doesn't mean that the top prizes skew the ranking list. You're still getting rewarded. You're getting, in the case of this, 3,600 points for winning a tournament. But it's not so far away from second place or third place. You know, we always say about Gibraltar's the one that's always mentioned, 50,000 to the winner and 6,000 in the semis. But actually the World Championship, when you think about it, 500,000 for winning that ranking points, 100,000 in the semis. So it's a big drop off even just one round. So if the ranking system is going to change, there's no sign that it will, but if it is going to change, I don't think Neil's idea would be the way I would go, but I maybe would go back to a point system like this that was established and seemed to certainly have a very accurate sort of reflection of the rankings. And then it's about rewarding maybe a bit more consistency rather than just one-off victory, maybe. There's arguments for the current system, definitely, because winning a tournament is a great achievement, and why shouldn't you have a big rankings boost? One thing to say about 92-93, of course, and this happened for decades until Barry Hearn took over, your ranking position was fixed for the whole season. So if you won a tournament early on in the season, you had no rankings boost. And, of course, that meant you were still playing a certain number of rounds and you were still playing maybe the harder players earlier on in the tournament. If you were ranked number 6 in the world at the start of the season, you were ranked there until the end of the season when the new list came in. I think it's much better now that we have flexibility. People can rise up the rankings. And so you get to the Masters, and in theory, it is the best 16 players on that cycle. But anyway, thanks, Neil, for the email. And, maybe file it alongside your doubles idea, which also didn't take off. You never know, though. You know, it could excite people. And do let us know, anyone listening who have comments on that. But just to recap on what Neil's idea is, basically, it's reflective of not just how you do in a tournament, but who knocks you out. So, example again, Dave Gilbert was beaten in the first round at the Crucible by Ronnie O'Sullivan. So on this ranking list, Dave Gilbert is 17th because he lost to the eventual winner. Ronnie, of course, number one. We'll move on, I think. So as I said at the start, big news about the podcast is back. And, you know, we're always trying to innovate. There's always new people coming along. Phil Seymour and Sean Murphy apparently starting a podcast, you know. So there's all these rivals, you know, and it's important to refresh the act. Yeah, it sounds really refreshed, doesn't it, bearing on the last half an hour. But anyway, the news is this, and this will only be for a few weeks. This will not be for the whole year, but for the next few weeks, there will in fact be two editions a week of the Snooker Scene podcast. Monday and Thursday, a bit like Blue Peter when I was growing up. And the first one will be kind of a discussion, so there'll be emails and there'll be reflections from fans, if we get any. And the second one, hopefully each week, will be an interview. And this week, as long as all goes well and we can get it done, I'll be speaking to Robert Milkins. Yes, I will. Robert Milkins, who, of course, pretty sensationally won the Gibraltar Open last season. So I'll be very interested to talk to him about that and his career. So that'll be on Thursday. I'd like to say it's for premium subscribers who pay me, you know, £5 a week. It's not, because we don't have any of that, and I wouldn't have the nerve to charge either. I should be paying you, frankly. But anyway, so that will be for the first few weeks of the season. Not every week, but for the first few weeks, there'll be two editions of the Snooker Scene podcast. What a time to be alive. On that point, we, of course, value your emails. So do let us know about anything that's happening in the snooker world. And particularly for next week, our fan special. If you've got any views on what it is to be a snooker fan, then let me know at snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. That's snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. We're still part of the Sports Social Network, so do check out their other podcasts. But that's it for now, so I'll be back on Thursday. Oh, yes, it's an extraordinary time. Having threatened to pack it all in, I'm now doing two editions a week. I think the phrase, careful what you wish for, is springs to mind. But yes, hopefully I'll be able to sort that out with Rob Milkins. And for the meantime, why not, as we start Season 8, we'll sign off with a good bye-bye.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.